them to try and stop and slow down. And that's why to have seen her joined by debutante Lois Pearson, Liv Cheen in that attacking end, Imogen Allison, getting better and better with every game, just means that we're stronger as a unit, not just these individuals.
We wish you all the best, Jess. Rose's head coach, Jess Thelby, into that decider, 10 a.m. this morning. Good luck.
The Voice of the UK.
This is Five Live Breakfast.
Five Live Breakfast, Rachel Bird and Claire McDonald with you today. Thank you for your company. Here are the news headlines at 7 o'clock. Sir Keir Starmer has warned Brits still in Lebanon to leave immediately as violence between Israel and Hezbollah escalates. Speaking on board a plane to New York, where he will attend the annual UN General Assembly, the Prime Minister said the government was ramping up contingency plans. Our diplomatic correspondent is James Landale.
He said that we are potentially at what he called a brink point and we have to come back from that brink. We need a ceasefire, we need to de-escalate. And this is something that I think most of the leaders who are here in New York at the UN are, they're saying that, they're saying it to each other, they're saying it to anybody who can listen. And that is because there's a genuine fear that there will be further escalation, that this isn't the end of, you know, what we've seen over the last week or so is not the end of it.
British troops are being sent to Cyprus to help possible evacuations in Lebanon.
Well, before the Prime Minister headed to New York, he did an interview with us here for Five Live Breakfast, which we'll play you in just a moment. And he told me his MP should exercise judgment when it comes to donations of clothing and gifts. One of the things we spoke about was gifted accommodation during the election campaign.
My son was doing his GCSEs. We had lots of journalists outside our house. I'm not complaining about that, but I had promised him faithfully that I would give him an environment in which he could calmly get on his one chance to do his GCSEs, and therefore we relocated somewhere else, a gift, which we then allocated a sum of money to. So sometimes what sits behind these are human explanations. Mm-hmm. But look, now we're in government, I think, if you take, for example, clothing, I think that's, you know, in the hurly-burly of an election campaign is one thing. We're in government now, and so you won't see clothing declarations from me again.
Senior sources have told the BBC there's growing unease within the NHS in England about the government's message that the health service is broken. Some hospital leaders have expressed their concerns ahead of the Health Secretary's speech to the Labour Party conference this morning.
Prosecutors in the United States have charged a man with the attempted assassination of Donald Trump. Ryan Ruth was already facing two gun-related charges after he was accused of pointing a rifle through a fence at Mr. Trump's golf club in Florida earlier this month.
And according to global research, children's eyesight is steadily getting worse, with one in three now short-sighted. Analysts say COVID lockdowns had a negative impact as children spent more time on screens. Japan and South Korea have some of the highest rates of short-sightedness.
Loads of texts coming in are In My Opinion today, which is all about whether swearing improves your performance in sport. Lots of people, I think, talking from personal experience, which we'll get into in just a moment. Mm. I mean, we are generally quite clean-mouthed.
On air.
Yeah.
And then I turned round to one of our editors earlier. I said, is my language quite bad in meetings? He said, just put it this way, I have to turn the volume down when I've got children on in the background.
That doesn't surprise me. Standards slipping, Katie.
What are you two like? I don't think standards were ever up. No. They've always
bar was
been
always
slipped.
Pretty low.
Yeah. Well, England's standing captain, Harry Brook, hit a first ODI century to help the hosts win a rain-affected third match against Australia by 46 runs yesterday. It was on the DLS method in Durham, and it keeps the five-match series alive. Now, he also thinks, Harry Brook, that people took his comments the wrong way last week. It's when he said he wasn't fussed whether his side were getting caught going for big shots. Brook has now clarified he didn't mean who cares if we lose. He says we still want to win, but you don't want to go out there and have a fear of getting out. All four Premier League teams in action last night made it through to the fourth round of the EFL Cup, but Leicester were taken to penalties by League Two Walsall. Christopher Nkunku scored a hat-trick as Chelsea thrashed Barrow 5-0, while Pep Guardiola says midfielder Rodri will be out for a long time after his knee injury, but they are still waiting to confirm the severity of it. Sorry, City made 9 changes as they beat Watford 2-1, and it was gold for Kat Ferguson, Felix Barrett and Fran Brown as Great Britain won 9 medals on day 4 at the Road and Paracycling Road World Championships in Zurich.
Katie, thank you. Helen Sue with the weather. Morning again.
Hello again. Good morning, Claire and Rachel. Hello there. More rain on the way today. It's a showery story across Scotland, though. It's a cold and frosty start. There's a little bit of fog around, but there'll be some bright sunshine for many central and southern areas, which is obviously a big difference on the weekend and Monday, but we do have showers fairly numerous in the north and the west, and as the northeasterly wind develops, that will make it feel quite chilly as well, just 10 or 11. For Northern Ireland, a lot of dry weather, one or two showers for the east coast, but they're few and far between for the majority. Plenty of sunshine, cold start, a little bit of mist and fog, some sunshine, but then the cloud does come in this afternoon and rain towards tea time moves up from the south. The same rain that's going to be affecting England and Wales through the day ahead. In fact, it already is affecting some southern areas. It's fairly patchy at the moment, but it will tend to become more organised and heavier coming in from the southwest. The heaviest rain, Wales and the southwest through the morning, the Midlands into eastern parts of England and northern England as we go through the afternoon and evening. For the evening rush, pretty miserable conditions as well. So tempered, obviously, temperature-wise, 12 or 13, strong winds in the south, 17 if we do see the sunshine, but fairly limited today, I'm afraid.
And how about the travel on? What's going on?
So we've got some localised flooding, residual flooding left, but not a lot of it. The A421 is still closed in both directions to and from the M1 at Junction 13 for Bedford. The M4, Prince of Wales Bridge, Second Severn Crossing. So one lane's blocked by an accident. It's on the eastbound side, so from Wales to England. Then the A13, there's an obstruction. It's affecting you on the Stamford La Hope bypass westbound at Orsett Cock. M25, usual queues into the roadworks clockwise at 5 near the M26. Particularly bad, actually, taking about half an hour. And M27, very heavy this morning, 8 at Burselden, westbound. That's again because of roadworks. And Eurotunnel, delays of an hour on the passenger service at Folkestone on a merchant, 5 Live Travel.
The voice of the UK.
This is 5 Live Breakfast.
Good morning, everyone. It's Wednesday morning, 25th of September. Claire and Rach with you this morning. We've got developing news from the Middle East today. The Ministry of Defence sending 700 troops to Cyprus to prepare for the possible evacuation of British nationals from Lebanon.
Yes, Israeli strikes have reportedly killed more than 560 people this week alone, and tens of thousands are now fleeing their homes across the country. A reminder, Israel says it's aiming to remove the threat from Hezbollah and return displaced residents to northern Israel, whilst Hezbollah says it is resisting what it calls Israeli aggression and acting in solidarity with Palestinians in Gaza. We heard from our correspondent Hugo Bechega just before seven.
There is a sense that things have changed. I think people now are very concerned that this could be the beginning of a wider Israeli offensive against Hezbollah. And we've seen those airstrikes. There is speculation that there could be a ground invasion of southern Lebanon to try to create a so-called buffer zone along the border. And Hezbollah is not showing any signs, any indications that it is willing to back down. So these attacks are likely to continue. So I think the concern now across the country is that this has the potential to become a major war between Hezbollah and Israel.
Well, we'll have more on this before 8 o'clock. And as Claire mentioned earlier, we'll talk to the former ambassador to the UN, British ambassador to the UN about this as well, because the Prime Minister is now in New York for the General Assembly, where world leaders will discuss the crisis. Quite what they'll be able to do is another question. But Keir Starmer has spent the last few days at the Labour conference in Liverpool, which finishes later today. And includes a delayed debate on those controversial changes to winter fuel payments. I caught up with the Prime Minister yesterday after he delivered his speech. It was one of those where he did a series of interviews for all the major broadcasters. So you are ushered into a corridor in a hotel near the conference centre. All the, I suppose, the breakfast show hosts of the various different outputs are there waiting in the corridor. So Susanna Reid is there from GMB, and Sally's there from Breakfast TV. Nick Robinson's floating around, the guy from other commercial stations, all of that. Right. So it's quite interesting because there's kind of dynamics between all of you half talking about what you're going to ask, but not wanting to give too much away. Obviously, loads of people. I mean, I don't know who they are. Are they researchers? Are they SPADs? Are they assistants? Whatever. Just hanging around and telling you to kind of be quiet. And then you're filtered into this room and you're sat down. You've got the glare of the camera lights on you and it's 8 minutes. It's go. Right. And you've got to try and get as much as you possibly can into in that time. So you will hear us talk about freebies, talking about homes for veterans, and also talking about moving his family into Downing Street. So let us know what you think to his answers. But I started about asking him about his time. Well, specifically what I said to him was, has it gone to plan, his first 3 months in government? And this is what he said.
Well, Prime Minister, congratulations on your first conference speech as Prime Minister. Would you say that the first 3 months in government has gone to plan?
We've been acting to plan, which is we said we'd come into government and start by fixing the foundations. And if you look at what we've done in the first 3 months, we've already shown that change has begun. And that's why I listed in my conference speech all the things that we've already done, whether that's setting up the National Wealth Fund, launching Great British Energy, dealing with, unlawful evictions, today announcing the Hillsborough Law, which has been too long in the waiting, in my view, making sure that we're going to deal with homelessness for veterans. There's a long list of changes that have already begun. But what I also said today was, it's a long journey. It's a tough journey. There are going to be trade-offs along the way. But in the long term, the Britain that we're building is going to be a Britain where people are better off, where their public services are working properly. The NHS is back up on its
feet. I understand those are your aspirations, but it has been personally tough for you. Your personal popularity rating has slumped down 21 points amongst all voters, 28 points among Labour voters. That surely can't have been part of the plan. And the row over winter fuel payments and freebies has really bitten hard, hasn't it?
Look, I didn't come into politics to spend my time looking at opinion polls. I'll be judged, and rightly judged, on whether I deliver what I said we'd deliver at the election. So I'll be judged on whether we've improved living standards, whether people feel better off. I'll be judged by whether our public services are back up and functioning as people desperately want. I'll be judged by the NHS. Has it improved? Are the waiting lists down? Is it coping for the future? I'll be judged, the next election on that, and quite rightly so. And, I have to say, that is where my entire focus is. I didn't come into politics to sort of gaze at opinion polls. I came into politics to change lives, and that's been the driver for everything
I've
done.
But you did say, up there on that stage, you said it was a shared struggle. Well, we had this text from a Five Live listener, Ian in Neath, who says, if it's a shared struggle, where are my free clothes?
Well, look,
it doesn't feel like the struggle is being shared equally.
Well, the struggle is across the NHS, across our economy. These are big, serious issues that we are addressing, and they're going to be addressed by taking tough, tough decisions. And I think, what we've shown in the first 3 months is delivery already, considerable delivery, change has begun, a steely determination not to be buffeted around by the issues of the day, but to remind ourselves every day, as I do, that my job is to improve the economy and make sure it works for everyone, to make sure that everybody's better off. That is only going to happen if we take the tough decisions. A terrible inheritance. The government left a complete mess on top of the economic mess. We've discovered this £22 billion black hole. That is really hard to deal with, but we will deal with it. We've inherited a prison system which is bursting at the seams.
But I have to make you aware that our listeners are fully aware of all those issues.
Yeah.
You presented them repeatedly through the election campaign. What they want to know is how you're going to move things on from here. And there is a dissonance between politicians taking thousands of pounds in freebies and pensioners being asked to give up, many of them, this critical payment. Now, can I just look at another issue? For example, on the freebies, you received, over the course of the last Parliament, £35,000 worth of football tickets for free. The Taylor Swift concert, £4,000 worth of hospitality there from the Premier League. Now, there is an issue there, isn't there? Because your government is engaged in a process of setting up a new football regulator. So if you're taking freebies from the Premier League, can't you see how that raises concerns?
Well, let me just deal with that because, as you know, I'm passionate about football. I go to a lot of football games. I've got season tickets at Arsenal, which I fully pay for. I go with my boy. But because of security that I've had now in place for some time, and obviously that's gone up since I've been Prime Minister, then I can't sit in the stands where my season ticket is anymore. Therefore, the club and other clubs have said, well, you can be our guest in the director's box. Now, that doesn't cost the taxpayer a penny. A sum of money is allocated to it. You don't pay for it because you can't buy a ticket in the director's box, but you allocated a nominal sum towards it. And so that is purely about my passion for watching football and being able to take my son to Arsenal games. In relation to other elements on the register, some of it is for accommodation. When we were running into the election, my son was doing his GCSEs. And we had lots of journalists outside our house. I'm not complaining about that, but I had promised him faithfully that I would give him an environment in which he could calmly get on, his one chance to do his GCSEs, and therefore be relocated somewhere else, a gift, which we then allocated a sum of money to. So sometimes what sits behind these are human explanations. Mm-hmm. But look, now we're in government. I think if you take, for example, clothing, I think that's, you know, when the hurly-burly of an election campaign is one thing. We're in government now, and so you won't see clothing declarations from me again.
So will MPs be able to take freebies in other forms outside of clothing, Labour MPs?
Well, I think every MP has to exercise judgment, and I would expect them to exercise judgment.
So you're not banning all gifts?
Well, you have to exercise judgment. I expect people to exercise judgment. And the rules in place, the framework, is quite rightly that all has to be declared so that everybody can see it. But my MPs, my cabinet and I are focusing every day on the job we're elected to do,
which is to deliver the change for the country. Important policy announced today, Homes for Heroes, and care leavers and domestic abuse victims. So what's the detail? How many homes? When are they going to be available? What's that going to cost?
Well, I'm really pleased to make those announcements today because they're very important for veterans, for care leavers, and for those who have been subject to domestic abuse. The only reason we can do it is because we changed the planning rules. We've taken a decision which the last government was too afraid to take. So we now need to change the regulations to allow it to happen. But the commitment I've made is that all of those who are homeless will have a roof over their
head.
When
will that happen?
Well, we need to pass the necessary regulation and get on with the job. I haven't got a date, an arbitrary date that I'll give you.
And do you know how many homes you're going to need?
Well, we've looked at the numbers that we need, assessed it, but we're only able to do this because we've turbocharged the planning. That is the only reason
we can make
that
commitment. But I understand that, but you can't tell me the number of homes or how much is this going to cost. You haven't worked that out yet.
No, of course that's been worked out. That is all being worked out by the relevant department. What I announced today is the commitment to do it. And when I make a commitment like that, I also committed to the Hillsborough Law. These are serious commitments. One of my big criticisms of the last government is that it promised things which it didn't deliver. I've been really careful only to promise what we will deliver.
And
it's a huge mistake to do other than that.
Very much on board with that and very interested in that. Just finally, you mentioned your son, and I've got teenage kids. I'm right in the thick of those years, so I absolutely understand those pressures. And I often actually wonder what it is like for them and for you as a family making that transition, the scrutiny of being life in number 10. Can I ask how you are all managing and how that's gone?
Well, look, it's been tough for the kids. I'm not pleading a special case, but it's tough. They're 16 and 13. That's a very sort of important time in their lives. What we've done, Vic and I, is to be really clear that we won't name them in public. We won't have photographs done with them in public. We'll try to sort of put a ring of protection around them so that even living in number 10, as they now are, they can live as normal a life as possible and, you know, go to the same schools, have the same friends, do the same things they did before. And that is the way we've done it up to now. I intend to keep doing it. But, you know, is it really difficult for a 13-year-old girl and a 14-year-old boy to have to relocate from Kentish Town with all their friends, the security of the house, the only house they'd ever lived in, to somewhere else? Yeah, of course it's difficult for
them. Appreciate that. Have you managed your Friday night dinner yet?
Well, no, because every Friday night has been mucked up with work. But I think
a few people were suggesting that might happen.
Well, no, but and of course it happened in opposition. The point I was actually making when I talked about that, which I do really stand by, is it is important to carve out time for your family. Whether that time is will vary during the week, but I do genuinely think it's important for all politicians, me in particular, to have a quiet time with my wife and my kids. Whatever day it is, it is really important for the family. I think it's important. I think you make better decisions if you sometimes get a little bit of distance and spend a bit of time with your family.
Dragging them to the table is often the hardest part, isn't it? But that's another issue. Thank you, Prime Minister.
Thank you.
So loads of you reacting to what's been said in that interview. This one, is anyone checking how much the Tories took in freebies over the past decade? I don't think it's a one-sided thing. It certainly isn't. It's not just a Labour issue, that, not at all. Please take the clothes, says someone else. You're representing the country. Dean in Cambridge says, I see it's okay for Starmer to protect his son while exams are heading his way, but it's okay to force others to move school mid-term.
And this is a lot of parents picking up on the VAT being imposed on private schools, them having to move their children, saying that's the kind of disruption no one wants for their teenage children, but they're having to do it anyway.
Yeah, Pauline Wolverhampton says, in the public sector, there is no way I would be allowed to accept football or concert tickets from an external client, never mind clothes, accommodation, meals, holidays, etc. Just ban politicians from accepting gifts over £50. No exceptions. No waffle about allowing common sense and having no fear or favour. We know they're not capable. So do what the rest of us have to and don't accept the bribe, says Paul.
So let's talk to our chief political correspondent, Henry Zeffman, who's still in Liverpool, actually. Hi, Henry.
Hi, Rachel. Still here.
Yeah, good. So, I mean, you're probably starmed out by this morning after sitting through the speech and then all his interviews yesterday. But what particularly stood out for you in that conversation?
I mean, if I was starmed out, I'd be in the wrong job. I think there's going to be quite a lot of him over the next few years. Well, look, what stood out to me, I think, firstly, and it's kind of where you both began and ended the interview, you know, the very forthright defence of the story that dominated the run-up to this party conference, to the frustration of Keir Starmer and a lot of his team, the stuff around Lord Ali and his donations, and then, you know, as you brought it back towards the end there, about him living his life in Downing Street, because that's what this is all bound up with. And actually, you've got a new fact out of him, which we weren't aware of before, but he disclosed to you there in that interview, which is that actually, for a period during the election campaign, it seems that the Starmer family moved into a flat owned by Lord Ali. Now, he said that was because of his son needing a quiet place to study for his GCSEs. It's clearly the case that his kids are at, you know, possibly the most awkward possible age for kids of a prime minister to live in Downing Street. If they were much younger, it might be easier. And if they were much older, it certainly would be easier. You know, more generally, what stood out to me is that, you know, this is a prime minister who's adamant that he is taking tough decisions and grappling with tough trade-offs in a way that his predecessors didn't. I think that's fine for now, but I think when these interviews roll around in a year's time, when he's at his next party conference in a year's time, he is going to have something to show for that.
Yeah, and listen, by the way, there's loads more analysis with Henry and the whole political team actually on Newscast if you want to dig into that in more detail, which I very much enjoyed listening to on my way into work this morning. But let's move on to other matters. What's happening today? Because he's over in New York at the moment and he's back on the world stage, so very much away from domestic issues for the next 24 hours.
That's right. He flew to New York overnight. I mean, I was struck that there was almost nothing about foreign policy in Keir Starmer's speech to the Labour Party conference yesterday, despite it dominating, I think, so much of his first 3 months as Prime Minister. But it's certainly going to dominate his next few days in New York. It's an annual thing, the UN General Assembly. You basically get every world leader descending on New York for a few days at the same time. But clearly it comes this year at an acute moment of global crisis, particularly in the Middle East. And on the flight over to New York, Keir Starmer told our colleague Chris Mason and others that British nationals in Lebanon need to leave immediately. He said he's deeply concerned that the Middle East is at a brink point, and he says we have to come back from the brink. 700 British forces personnel have moved or are moving to RAF Akrotiri. That's a British base in Cyprus. They're there as a contingency, but a contingency that increasingly people in government are fearing might have to be activated in order to help evacuate thousands of British nationals. There's probably about 10,000 there from Lebanon.
Yeah, and there's another story actually around today that the government might need to address. And this is, is it senior leaders in the health service saying that they are concerned about the knock-on impact of the government talking about the NHS in terms of it being broken, and that this has repercussions for people's confidence in the health service. They may not even go and seek treatment when they need it because they have such little faith in it.
It's such an interesting story, this, isn't it, Rachel, from our colleague Nick Triggle. So we've heard a bit, haven't we, over the last few weeks about concerns from people in business that the government being gloomy about the economy is actually making economic prospects worse. And what this story kind of is a health version of that. So one of the first things that Wes Streeting said when he became health secretary, getting on for 3 months ago, was that the NHS in England is broken. And he keeps using that word. He keeps saying that the NHS is broken. And Nick Triggle has spoken to people at the top of the NHS who say they're pretty uneasy with that. They're worried that it would mean, it might mean some patients being put off seeking help. It might mean lasting damage to staff morale when you need the staff to be part of making the change in the NHS. He's spoken to one hospital leader who says they're worried about spooking patients. Now, Department for Health spokesperson says, actually, patients and staff can see that the NHS is going through the biggest crisis in its history, and what they want from the government is for the government to be honest. We will hear from Wes Streeting, the Health Secretary, today, because the Labour Party conference still has a few hours left in it, and he's got one of the final, if not actually perhaps literally the final speech. And he says in that speech, he's talking about ways to improve care, particularly in those parts of the country where the highest numbers of people are out of work due to ill health. I think if policies like that work in cutting waiting lists, then in a little while, not many people are going to care what adjectives he used to describe the NHS.
Andrew, thank you very much. Hope you have a little bit of wind down from Liverpool before you're gearing up for the next one. The Tory conference starts when? On Sunday, is it?
It starts on Sunday, but I'll be there on Saturday. So,
of course you will be.
I've spoken to a lot of people here at Labour Party conference. Labour people saying, oh, so exhausted after 4 days. I said, hang on, I was at the Lib Dems last week. I'm going to the Conservatives next week. Come on, guys.
Where's their stamina? Thanks, Henry. Thanks for all your work. Henry Zeffman, our chief political correspondent. So, of course, we'll be covering the Conservative Party conference next week. Nikki's going to be taking calls on Starmer at 9. We're going to be getting reaction to his speech yesterday and to our interview with him from voters who were at the conference after 8 o'clock this morning, 7.25.
This week on 5 Live and 5 Sports Extra.
Tomorrow, there's ball-by-ball commentary from the county championship on 5 Sports Extra.
He's in cold, and that is that.
And tonight at 8, we'll have updates from the Europa League and live commentary as Liverpool face West Ham in the EFL Cup.
High back in!
Live Sports.
Listen on BBC Sounds.
5 Live Breakfast. In my opinion.
In my opinion.
In my opinion.
And in my opinion.
Today's In My Opinion is about swearing in sports. It has come about because of a row in Formula One. The president of the FIA, Mohammed bin Suleiman, has suggested he wants to hear less swearing from drivers on their team radios. Also, Max Verstappen then swore in a press conference and was given a day's community service as a punishment. It got us thinking a bit more about swearing and its place in sport more generally, and where swearing is or isn't acceptable. Have a listen to our guest.
Hey Rachel and Claire, my name is Dr. Richard Stevens. I am a psychologist and academic with a long-standing interest in researching the performance-enhancing effects of swearing. And in my opinion, there's nothing wrong with swearing in sports. My university-based research has shown that swearing helps people to endure pain and boosts their physical performance, useful for gaining an edge over your opponents. Research has also shown how in intense, stressful situations, swearing conveys emotion quickly and efficiently, like almost no other form of language. Just what you need in a team. Even in Formula One, when drivers who may be teammates curse each other out after being cut up out on track, it's raw, it's real, and sometimes it's exactly what's needed.
5 Live Breakfast.
The voice of the UK.
So we're going to talk to Dr. Richard Stevens before 8 o'clock. Loads of you have been sending in your messages. Just a couple of quick ones here. The problem with swearing in sport is it opens the floodgates. Who decides when it's appropriate? It's always going to be subjective. Our kids are hugely influenced by sports stars. This is not the direction we need. And this one here, if something goes wrong at work, I don't start loudly shouting expletives or punching walls. Stop making excuses for sports people who ultimately aren't doing anything that is remotely life or death in importance.
Yes, keep them coming in. 85058, 28 minutes past 7. Chelsea, Man City, Arsenal, Liverpool, Man United. That was the top five in the Women's Super League last year. They're also arguably the five biggest men's clubs in England as well. But with women's football booming, could it be possible in the future for a women's club to reach the top without a male team also supporting it? Well, that is the aim of a new investment group called Mercury 13, who've spoken to BBC Sport about their plan to invest £80 million into transforming women's clubs around the world. Its co-founder is Victoire Gojanvina Reynal. And Victoire joins us now. Good morning.
Good morning. Thank you very much for having me.
Thank you so much for joining us. Your group, let's talk about what you've done. At home, FC Como Women, You bought that out, and you said at the time, we're a football club, but at the same time, we're building a platform which goes way beyond just football. So what do you mean by that, and how do you hope to bring that to these shores?
So we truly believe, in conjunction with the name of the group, which is Mercury 13, which is in a homage to the 13 women that trained to be the first female astronauts to go to the moon back in the 60s, but didn't get the opportunity because NASA declined their mission on the basis of their gender. There were women and that made them not good enough to go to the moon. We believe that if they had gone, they would have completely changed the trajectory of gender equality. Women would have realized that they could be astronauts, scientists, and things would have been vastly different today. Now, we get a shot of doing this again, but through football. And having younger girls and boys seeing professional female footballers may change the trajectory of gender equality. And that is what we're referring to when we think of our platform to have a lot more impact than just being a football club competing in a league.
And it's so interesting to see what's happened in the States, because in many ways they are so far ahead of the rest of the world. I mean, you've brought in notable figures on board, including Annie Aluko, ex-England international. She was once sporting director at Angel City FC in the National Women's Soccer League in the US, a club recently sold for a record-breaking $250 million. So I guess this demonstrates that if you invest and you get the right people on board, there is a huge market for this.
Yes, especially in Europe. I think in the US, soccer, football has always been a woman's sport. However, on this side of the pond, it's been a lot more related to men. And there's this opportunity that's opening up where, you know, traditional football clubs that have had a women's team or even independent women's teams such as Como are seeing a chance to be able to position themselves at the top and to take advantage of the momentum that the industry has generated. And we truly believe in that. So for Mercury's entire goal is to set a presence in the top five leagues in Europe and be able to compete with some of the biggest brands.
Yeah, it's so interesting. Yeah, and it's so interesting because obviously since England's Lionesses won the Euros, we've had this slow build of, and I've been many times to see WSL teams in what were traditionally known as the men's stadiums. I mean, obviously people will still refer to them as that. I've been corrected on air by elite women footballers who say, no, don't describe it as that. You know, this is the stadium for the elite teams. And yet, you know, women, even at the top of the game here in England, still have a kind of much smaller stadium and are allowed into the bigger stadiums on occasion. So what needs to change? And I guess, of course, the thing is you need to build the game before you can actually invest in the infrastructure to get the people in. So how do you square that circle?
So we truly believe in the commercialization of the women's game, and we believe it essentially presents an opportunity for us to build a financially sustainable model out of it. And it's kind of flipping the model that men's have. Usually when you see an investment on a men's team, you'll see that investment replicated on the pitch almost immediately. They'll go buy better players, build a stronger squad, then go after sporting results. And once those come in, then they'll commercialize their assets. We believe that by imposing a kind of reversed flywheel where the commercialization of the assets can then allow us to reinvest on the pitch and infrastructure, will generate this virtuous loop where we can continually grow our clubs in a sustainable way. Because ultimately, the biggest problem that we see in women's football is the dependencies that have been generated, whether it's by the men's team or by a local government or by the federations, These teams always are at the mercy of someone else, and yes, we need to give them that emancipation.
And we've seen that recently with Reading FC in this country. You know, the women's team kind of stand, you know, say, you know, flying or drowning on, depending on what the men's team is up to. Just really brief final question to you, Victoire. Where do you want to be in 5 years' time with this investment into women's football in the UK?
In the UK, great question. Well, the WSL is one of the most important leagues for us, and we are working really hard to build a presence over here. We're London-based as a team as well. So hopefully we'll have the five teams in our portfolio and we'll be playing Champions League.
So good to talk to you. Thank you so much for coming on. Victoire Gojanvina Reynal there. She is co-founder of Mercury 13, aiming to revolutionise investment in women's football here in the UK and across Europe as well. Just after 7:30, time for the headlines.
This is BBC Radio 5 Live.
And here they are. Sir Keir Starmer has issued a blunt warning to British nationals still in Lebanon to leave immediately after voicing his fears the Middle East could be on the brink of all-out war. Sir Keir says the government's making urgent contingency plans after escalating violence between Israel and Hezbollah. British troops are being sent to Cyprus to help with a possible evacuation from Lebanon.
Israel says it's intercepted a missile from Lebanon in what appears to be the first time Hezbollah has fired at Tel Aviv. The group says it was targeted the headquarters of Israel's intelligence agency Mossad in retaliation for recent attacks.
There's growing unease within the NHS about the government saying it's broken. Senior sources in the health service has told the BBC they believe some of the claims may result in patients being put off seeking help and causing lasting damage to staff morale.
And prosecutors in the United States have charged a man with the attempted assassination of Donald Trump. Ryan Ruth was already facing a two gun-related charges after he was accused of pointing a rifle through a fence at Mr. Trump's golf club in Florida earlier this month.
And the rain, it seems never ending, I think, for a lot of people at the moment, Helen.
Yeah, it does, doesn't it, Rachel? There's more due today for England and Wales. It's already patchy across southern England already, so it'll turn heavier as it comes in from the Atlantic, driven in by fairly strong winds in the south, and it'll push across all parts of England and Wales by this evening's rush. So pretty miserable for many with a good inch of rain. Some sunshine ahead of that, temperatures 12 or 13, but for Scotland and Northern Ireland, it's a cold start, but sunny. We've got a little bit of fog to clear. As it does so, then good spells of sunshine. The cloud will tend to increase because that weather front's moving up from the south. But I think for the northwest of Scotland, quite a rash of showers today. I'm feeling cold, a strong northeast wind picking up, just 10 or 11 here. I'll have more later.
I felt I should have put another layer on this morning, and no mistake. Don't know whether that's a helpful contribution.
I was scarf and hat. This morning. Yeah. In fact, the scarf's only just come off. I've only just thawed out.
It is cold. It is cold. That's the voice of Katie.
Down a well. My mic's not on.
Here's order.
Okay, very quickly. So M25, the Dartford Tunnel, the left-hand tunnel's closed now, so you've got queues anti-clockwise towards the Dartford crossing. The East India Dock Tunnel is closed eastbound, causing queues back to the A13 at Canning Town flyover. The M1, north of 28 at Alfreton, an accident's happened. Long queues there, the roundabout, one lane down. The M6 in the West Midlands, everything at a stand. Junction 7 at Great Bar on the southbound side is because of an accident. Orna Merchant, 5 Live Travel.
The voice of the UK.
This is 5 Live Breakfast.
Right, Katie, Harry Brook, England's Harry Brook, was in the firing line, wasn't he, after comments he made after that first one-day international against Australia. This was a really important one yesterday because otherwise it, well, was heading towards a series defeat.
Yeah, it would have been
England.
All over.
But he put the record straight.
He has. So he is, Harry Brook, the standing captain at the moment while Joss Butler's out injured. And he said at Trent Bridge last week, if you get caught somewhere on the boundary or in the field, then who cares? Yesterday, he scored a match-winning first ODI century at Chesler Street, as you say, to make sure England clung on in the series. So they won by 46 runs on the DLS method. And he then came out and clarified that they're trying to instill the aggressive attitude that has defined the England test side. And Sir Alistair Cook last week was saying, you know, I think we understand what he's trying to say, but he might cringe at his actual comments. So Brook has now clarified, I don't mean who cares if we lose. We still want to win, but you don't want to go out there and have a fear of getting out. So given all of that, how was he actually feeling last night?
Relieved, but yeah, very pleased with the way that we've gone about the game there. Yeah, it's nice to get my first 100 and just got to keep on working hard and doubling down on my process and keep working hard and practicing the way I want to play in the game.
So it's all poised quite nicely now. 2-1 to Australia in the five-match series and they play again on Friday.
So that's the cricket. As for the football, Manchester City aren't going to have Rodri for a long time. We've known that that injury is pretty serious, but they did reach the fourth round of the EFL Cup without him last night.
Yeah, so Pep Guardiola just saying they're still waiting on a time frame to learn the severity of his knee injury. That's Rodri. But City made nine changes, 1-2-1 against Watford. The match, though, came just, I mean, literally 2 days after that 2-2 draw with Arsenal that was so intense. Pep Guardiola said, and really quite bluntly, that the EFL Cup is going to be a low priority going forwards.
We play 50 hours ago, so we cannot, and players play a lot of minutes. So absolutely, I'm not going to take a risk in this competition. I would say the next round is going to play the players who play the less minutes or the second team. We are not going to waste energy for this competition, for sure.
Enzo Maresca made 11 changes to his Chelsea side. He thrashed League Two Barrow 5-0. Probably the most expensive B team you will ever see in the world. So we've done the maths, producer John totting that up. £370 million that cost. If you look at Barrow's record signing from a few years ago, £100,000. So yeah, big disparity in that. A couple of nice stories to finish with though. So 55,000 tickets for next year's Women's Rugby World Cup have already been sold after just 2 days. The first allocation for the final at Twickenham has already sold out, and even the chief of women's rugby at World Rugby has admitted that she had to get in the online queue like everyone else.
The ticket sales going tremendously this morning. I've come out of the queue. It was great. It was like queuing for Oasis tickets. It was amazing. I was there watching the numbers go down, so trying to buy tickets for my friends and family, which was fantastic.
But they weren't charged £350 when they finally got through.
Don't think there was dynamic pricing going on. But you know what? There's big demand there. So who knows? That was Sally Horrocks. And nice tennis story to finish on for you, Claire, because we get to spend lots of time at Wimbledon together every year, don't we? This is brilliant. So former US Open champion Marin Cilic has now become the lowest ranked player to ever win an ATP Tour title. So he's had loads of surgeries on his knee. He's barely been playing. Aged almost 36, was ranked 777 in the world, went to the Hangzhou Open as a wild card and won. So that means he's going to now rise 404 places in the world ranking.
I love those stories. They are my favourite sporting stories. Just never, ever give up. Delighted to say, actually, we hope to speak to her yesterday, a 22-year-old Sonny Cartal, who won her first WTA title, the Jasmine Open in Tunisia, and did rather well at Wimbledon as well. She qualified and got through to the third round.
Brilliant run, wasn't it?
She's going to be joining us on Breakfast in the final hour. So looking forward to that. Thanks, Katie.
Couple of texts on our interview with Keir Starmer then, which we played you just after 7. You can hear it again at 8. Terrible interview. Too much focus on freebies. No questions on the economy or foreign policy. Please shut up about stupid free tickets to football. Ask some useful questions. Someone else says, dodge the Taylor Swift Premier League question. We asked him about whether accepting tickets from the Premier League for the Taylor Swift concert caused any concerns, given that the government is trying to push through this new regulator for football at the moment. And he didn't really address that in his answer. This one here from Steve in Essex. Labour continue to defend their acceptance of gifts, saying that as long as they are declared, it's OK. There are also ethical and moral issues they should think about, and this seems to be lacking.
Yeah, I mean, it's interesting, actually, isn't it? Because a lot of MPs have been asked about this, and cabinet members as well at conference. Damien Jones, Chief Secretary to the Treasury, was asked yesterday. He accepted, I understand it, tickets to Taylor Swift, and he took his kids and he said it's just something nice to do. And you kind of think, OK, but if there's some sort of purpose to it, maybe you could understand the Prime Minister in waiting moving his family to somewhere that was more secure because his son is at a really crucial point in his education. You can argue with that both either way, but there's no kind of hard and fast rule on accepting these kind of gifts because it's something nice for your family. And that seems to be what is winding an awful lot of people up. This text that I'm incensed by the man's double standards. He's abusing his privilege to advantage his children whilst treating those of us who are trying our best, unaided by millionaire benefactors or the taxpayer, with utter disdain. I'm referring, of course, to tax on independent schools. I'm sick of being told piously that those with the broader shoulders should pay more when the government is going about this with a regressive tax wholly unrelated to my income or wealth. They've done no research. They understand nothing about what's going to happen because of their measure. They simply don't care. They like it, whether it levels down education standards or appropriate money from those with the temerity to decline the government's choice of school for their children, says this texter. So keep your texts coming in on that 85058. We're going to get the view of a couple of younger voters who were at the Labour Party conference just after 8 o'clock this morning. From, I think it's quite interesting, from sort of different sides of the Labour Party. A lot of dissent being shut down, as you probably saw the last 2 days. People being evicted for bringing up the fact that we still have many arms licences to Israel. A young man did that yesterday as well. So what do the younger end of the Labour Party think about what they heard yesterday? We'll be getting some views on that shortly. But also, Prime Minister, as you heard this morning, has warned British nationals still in Lebanon to leave immediately as violence escalates between Israel and Hezbollah. Sir Keir Starmer also said the government was ramping up contingency plans. 700 British troops are being sent to Cyprus to help possible evacuations. Earlier, we heard from our Middle East correspondent, Hugo Bechega, who's in the capital of Lebanon, Beirut. He gave us the latest on the situation.
There is a sense that things have changed. I think people now are very concerned that this could be the beginning of a wider Israeli offensive against Hezbollah. And we've seen those airstrikes. There is speculation that there could be a ground invasion of southern Lebanon to try to create a so-called buffer zone along the border. And Hezbollah is not showing any signs, any indications that it is willing to back down. So these attacks are likely to continue. So I think the concern now across the country is that this has the potential to become a major war between Hezbollah and Israel.
Yeah, I mean, it does feel like, as I say, a very precarious situation. Is there a sense that people are beginning to leave the country or at least move away from that border with Israel?
Yeah, we've seen a massive displacement of residents from southern Lebanon. Tens of thousands of people are now trying to leave southern Lebanon. I was in a shelter here in Beirut yesterday where 6,000 people, displaced residents, were sheltering. And I don't get a feeling that people are desperately trying to leave the country, because this is a conflict that has been happening for almost a year. There have been some cases of people, thinking that the situation had become too risky for them to stay. So I think people who perhaps don't want to be in the country and don't want to be in a situation where there is a war happening around them, they have already left the country. But I think what is happening now is that you see, again, countries urging their citizens to leave Lebanon, because the problem here is that there's only one functioning commercial airport. So if this airport has to suspend its operations, many people are stuck here, because the only way to leave the country by land is through Syria, which is obviously not an option for many people. So that's why, one of the reasons why I think lots of countries are now urging their citizens to leave the country.
Update we had just within the last hour from Hugo Bechega, our Middle East correspondent, who is still in Lebanon in the capital, Beirut. It's 14 to 8 now.
You've probably got a list of things your child needs for uni. Pans, cutlery, sheets, duvet, towels, you know. But this is a little reminder that they'll also need a TV licence to be covered to watch all the TV channels, live TV on streaming services and BBC iPlayer. On the downside, it's one more thing on your list. On the upside, you can continue to enjoy your favourite shows together on the family group chat. And they won't be bringing it home to be washed either. To find out more, search TV licence uni.
Right, a rare 25p coin could fetch up to 2,800 times its value when it goes up for auction in Wiltshire later. I could have done with this yesterday when I was counting out my pennies from my packet of crisps. The collector's item was handed out in change to a local man. So it's the same shape as an ordinary 20p piece. I didn't even realise these had been made. There are thought to be no more than 50 in circulation, even fewer made from this particular nickel brass. So this one's being sold in Royal Wooton Bassett. Experts there hope to sell the coin for between £500 and £700. You can actually see it on the BBC News website this morning.
That doesn't seem very much if there's only 50 of them. Anyway, coming up after eight, we're going to speak to former West Ham winger Matt Jarvis. His old side haven't had a great start to the Premier League season, and they're at Liverpool tonight in the League Cup.
But right now we've got a Welsh rugby legend, I'm going to say it, in the studio.
Lovely quick hands. It's a run to the line for Bigger. Dan Bigger goes over the line. bigger with the early attempt at a drop goal. He's got underneath it and it's over. What a start for Wales. 30 seconds gone.
Bigger's under the post. Dan Bigger for Wales, who lead in the quarterfinal.
I don't think, Dan, that really does justice to your entire career. That's 17 seconds. But is it quite nice to listen back to?
Very nice to listen back to. Firstly, thank you so much for having me on. It's an absolute pleasure to be here and chatting with you guys this morning.
You don't have to thank us. Believe me, it's a privilege to have you here with us. So some of the highlights there you heard from the career of Wales fly half Dan Bigger. He's in the studio with us now to talk about his autobiography, The Bigger Picture, which surely is a title you've had in your head since you were a child.
Well, my surname kind of lended itself quite nicely to, I suppose, lots of options: The Bigger Man, The Bigger Picture. So yeah, we went with The Bigger Picture and it felt like the right tone. Yeah.
It works. Right, nearly a year since you retired from international rugby after last year's World Cup, but you're still playing, of course, for Toulon in France. But I guess it is a moment for reflection. What's that whole process been like, telling your story?
It's been, when I got asked to do the book, I was a little bit reluctant because I thought, well, is there anybody actually interested in my story? Is it going to be, you know, is it going to be well received, or is there going to be anybody interested in it? And I sort of was a little bit reluctant. But then I suppose the more I thought about it, and I've never ever been on social media or anything like that, and I felt like it was a chance for me to tell my story, to have a voice, and just be open and honest in the book. The book isn't, you know, the book is just an open and honest account of my life, career. It's nice for me to be able to have my say on certain moments, certain people, certain matches. And it's been a really enjoyable process. I didn't think I'd enjoy it as much as I did. A lot of work has gone into it. And Ross Harris, who wrote it, was just, you know, the amount of work he had to put in on top of chatting to me and coming out to France with me and things like that. But
actually,
really
fair play for giving the writer credit, because that doesn't always happen there's a kind of writing experience.
It's funny because we definitely started out as author subject, as a relationship. Mm. But I think over the, whatever it's been, 18 months, 2 years, this has been in the pipeline. We've certainly become, I'd say, close friends off the back of it. And he's done a brilliant job. You know, there's some difficult topics in there to talk about. My mum passed away a few years ago, and Ross felt like it was important to fly out to France to spend that week with me to get the real picture.
That was in 2021, wasn't it? And you're incredibly close to your mum. So just tell us about why it was so important that part of your own story was out there.
Well, I wanted to do it justice for her as well. It was a really tough time for me and my sister in particular. And I wanted to make sure it was right. And Ross felt exactly the same. He didn't want it to be a Zoom interview or an over-the-phone call. It was important that we got... My sister came out as well, and we spent the whole week out there and made sure we just got it right.
Must have been emotional.
Yeah, it was. It was tough going back. And that's what I found in the book sometimes was certainly over the situations like my mum passing away a few years ago, reliving that was difficult to go back over.
How important was she to you in your rugby career?
She was my number one fan. She was a rugby fan before a mother. So it kind of became a dream for her, really, having a son playing for Wales and playing rugby and being able to go on trips and things like that. So without her influence, there's no way I'd be sitting here talking to you about writing an autobiography by any stretch. So for me, it was really important to have her. The book's dedicated to her. It's been a tough few years, but it's been... I think she'd be looking down and be pretty proud of the book and what's gone on since.
Exceptionally proud. And when you look at your career, numbers don't really tell the story, but 112 caps, 3 Six Nations titles, 3 World Cups, Lions tours. But also you've said that actually when you go back through your career, it's the disappointments that stand out for you. And I suppose how you've come back for that and you realise your own resilience, and that is maybe what's made you so successful and so enduring in the sport.
Yeah, I think it was it was funny when we did the process, because you sort of, everyone remember the Six Nations titles, the Lions tours, the 100 cat, etc. But for me, I kind of, when I look back and chatted with Ross through my career, I realised how many disappointments and how many lows there were. And for me, it was kind of, I suppose it highlighted my resilience, highlighted my mental strength, highlighted that I had longevity and the ability to sort of come back from disappointments. And I would speak about, that's kind of a bit of a theme throughout the book, really. There's loads of highs and loads of great moments, but I suppose it's almost the disappointing moments that are a theme throughout the book. and how I've been able to sort of come back from that and then come out the other side on a more positive note.
Talking about the highs, your career highlight, I think you say, is the 2013 Six Nations decider beating England 30-3 in Cardiff.
Yeah.
How much of that game do you remember? Can you replay in your head?
It's really for that whole day was just the best experience I've ever, you know, that was 11 years ago now. But it's the best, I suppose, from the moment we woke up in the hotel to having breakfast together.
Were you feeling it from the word?
I was just about to say the mood in that in the team room when we sat down for breakfast was different, and the whole atmosphere we could sense. The bus ride is always one of the most special parts of playing for Wales, going down St Mary's Street and Westgate Street with a bus in Cardiff. But it just felt different, the whole atmosphere from the walkthrough and before the game, breakfast, the bus ride in. I mean, the crowds, I mean, normally Wales, England is absolutely crazy in Cardiff, but this felt on another level. And then the analysis boys did a really good job from the Welsh squad. They put like a motivational DVD on from the previous games, just as with motivational music. And I think it was Eminem, Lose Yourself was the track. So it was kind of like a bit of a... So by the time we got to the stadium then, everyone felt like we were invincible already type of thing. And then obviously the anthem beforehand, you had guys who'd been playing 70, 80 caps, said they've never experienced the stadium like it.
Dan, listen, I've got so much to ask you, which we don't have time for. You know, the state of Welsh rugby at the moment, domestic rugby, international rugby, you know, where you go from here because you're still playing. But we're going to have to leave it. But in general, can I ask, are you feeling, after all the difficulties Welsh rugby has had, are you feeling optimistic about the future? Or do you think there's still quite a kind of tough period for Wales to go through?
I think at the minute it's clearly it's in a really tough period with not winning for a while. But I do think that there's enough positive signs and enough good players in Wales to make sure that there's a more positive autumn. I think the autumn will surprise a few people.
Still got faith in Gatland?
Yeah, absolutely. I think that him and the team around him is going to be important and the right people to lead Wales into the future. But yeah, I'm more optimistic than perhaps other people, and it's been great coming on to chat to you.
Well, stay with us. We haven't done with you quite yet.
Okay. No, we haven't. Take a listen to this.
Five Live Breakfast. In my opinion.
In my opinion.
In my opinion.
And in my opinion.
We have this little thing called In My Opinion, and today it's all about swearing in sport. It's after Max Verstappen threatened to quit F1 after receiving a punishment for swearing at a news conference. What about swearing? Where are you on that trajectory?
I'd be absolutely skint if I was fined for swearing in sport on the pitch and things like that. Yeah, I'd be having fines left, right and centre. But I think you have to accept that if you watch live sport, in press conferences and things like that, when you're speaking to people, it's completely different. But I do think that when you're on the field and in the moment, you know, it's impossible not to be caught up in the moment, in the atmosphere and the moment of live sport. But clearly in press conferences and things like that, it's okay. A very different scenario, in my opinion.
Thank goodness.
That's very on brand.
And it's a very valid opinion. Listen, F1's governing body, the FIA, issued Max Verstappen with a community service order. So Dr. Richard Stevens is a senior lecturer in psychology at Keele University. He's our In My Opinion guest today. Good morning.
Good morning.
So, I mean, you heard it there from an elite sports person that, you know, he'd be broke if he got fined for swearing while he's playing. Is there a difference then, in your opinion, between swearing in the heat of the moment and swearing in a press conference?
I think there is a difference between those things. I think in the heat of the moment of a sports event like that, elite sports, swearing helps. Swearing can give you an edge. My research has shown swearing can literally boost your strength and make you more tolerant to pain. And when you're kind of emotionally aroused, swearing comes more readily, which is just kind of somehow the right, it just somehow fits that situation. And as Dan seems to say, it helps, you know, you can't stop yourself from doing it. I think it is different in a press conference, but there may be some mitigating issues, because there is research that shows that swearing in a second language, so Max Verstappen was swearing in English, it doesn't have the same impact as the language that you grew up with.
Surely, I think, and I can't repeat the word he used when he was talking about his car, but I think we all know that that's a pretty bad one in any language.
Well, that's what I'm saying. It's much more resonant to say a word like that if your first language is English than if you're presumably Max Verstappen's first language is Dutch. So that could be a mitigating factor.
Okay, well, they didn't buy that one, but if it was. So what you're saying, you've done the science on this, have you? You've looked at it and gone, actually, it's helpful if you are trying to retrieve greatness in sport. In what way?
So we've done stuff on strength training. So we had a paper out a few years ago where we had people ride an exercise bike. And the task is a task where they have to ride flat out for 30 seconds against super high resistance. So it's really, really difficult. And we had one group who swore, repeated a swear word while they did that, and one group repeated a neutral word. And we saw increased power in the group that sweared.
Right. Is there not a danger, though, if you kind of say that's okay, what happens, even in a squad, even in a team of people where you have a load of people from, like, different kind of backgrounds, different, religious beliefs, that it could seep in, and it could see if there's an acceptability about swearing on the pitch, it just seeps into everyday life, and people find that offensive, and it isn't context where you use it all important.
I mean, one of the interesting things about swearing is whenever you swear, you're never quite sure how it's going to land and how people are going to react. And I think that's what keeps it potent. So yes, you do always take a risk when you swear that you might upset people. And presumably most people aren't setting out to upset other people. But it does help in some situations. And one of the things I say when I'm giving talks, it's a cheap, readily available, calorie neutral, drug-free means of self-help.
I love that. Dr. Richard Stevens, Senior Lecturer in Psychology at Keele University, thank you. Is swearing in sport acceptable? Someone said, sweary sports people. There was a lot of bleeped out swearing on Bake Off last night. Oh, well.
The Voice of the UK.
This is Five Live Breakfast.
Good morning. The government told British nationals to leave Lebanon immediately as fighting between Israel and Hezbollah escalates. The Ministry of Defence says additional troops are being sent to Cyprus as part of contingency plans to evacuate. Our Middle East correspondent Hugo Bechega has been speaking to us from the capital, Beirut.
The problem here is that there's only one functioning commercial airport. So if this airport has to suspend its operations, many people are stuck here because the only way to leave the country by land is through Syria, which is obviously not an option for many people. So that's why I think lots of countries are now urging their citizens to leave the country.
Israel says it's intercepted a missile from Lebanon in what appears to be the first time Hezbollah has fired at Tel Aviv. The group says it was targeting the headquarters of Israel's intelligence agency Mossad in retaliation for recent attacks.
The Prime Minister is attending the annual UN General Assembly and before heading to New York sat down with me for an interview here on Five Live Breakfast, which we'll play you in just a moment. But one of the topics I asked him about was donations of clothing and gifts.
Now we're in government, I think, if you take, for example, clothing, I think that's, you know, when the hurly-burly of an election campaign is one thing. We're in government now, and so you won't see clothing declarations from me again.
So will MPs be able to take freebies in other forms outside of clothing, Labour MPs?
Well, I think every MP has to exercise judgment, and I would expect them to exercise judgment.
So you're not
judgment.
Banning all gifts?
Well, you have to exercise judgment. I expect people to exercise judgment. And the rules in place, the framework, it quite rightly, that all has to be declared so that everybody can see it.
Senior sources have told the BBC there's growing unease within the NHS in England about the government's message that the health service is broken. There's concern some of the comments and claims have gone too far and could result in lasting damage to patient and staff confidence. The Department of Health says it's important to be honest about the scale of the challenge facing the health service.
Prosecutors in the US have charged a man with the attempted assassination of Donald Trump. Ryan Ruth was already facing two gun-related charges after he was accused of pointing a rifle through a fence at Mr. Trump's golf club in Florida earlier this year.